copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let me start. I think when you ask Christians, why do you believe in God? The usual answer you get is not one in terms of arguments. It may depend a little on the country. I think apologetics is quite developed in the United States and the UK, but in most of Europe, apologetics is not very well developed. So if you ask people, why do you believe in God? They will say something like, well, I had an encounter with God, or I experienced something of God, or I was in church and it touched me deeply, or I read the scriptures and I felt it was true. Something like that. Not an argument. Now, I think if you think about this, I think this is true generally. Lots of the things we deeply believe and that are foundational to our existence are not based on arguments. For instance, the equality of man and women, right? That they have the same rights. Or the idea that there is an external world, typical philosophical problem. Those things are usually not based on arguments, but we believe them nonetheless. And lots of the things we do are based on them. But if this is true, then how are things with the atheists? The typical picture, what I've believed myself for a long time, is that atheists are atheists because they have good arguments, or they think they have good arguments, against the existence of God. But if what I said is true, then it may very well be that atheists are not atheists because they have good arguments against the existence of God, but for different reasons. Now, today I'm going to talk about that. What drives the atheist? Why are atheists atheists? And just to be clear, I think there are quite a few atheists who do have good arguments, or at least initially seemingly good arguments, against the existence of God, who come up with arguments. But we'll see that with lots of them, that is not the case. And let me say a bit about the evidence that I will use for that. First piece of evidence is personal conversation. My personal conversation with lots of atheists. Here's one. This is Herman Philipsen, my supervisor. He is Holland's most well-known atheist, and he published a book with Oxford University Press last year entitled God in the Age of Science? A Critique of Religious Reason, in which he argues for atheism. I've had lots of conversations with him and with other atheists, so it's partly based on that. It's also based on this book, Philosophers Without Gods, about 25 testimonies of atheists about why they are atheists. You would expect good arguments against the existence of God in this book, but when you read it, remarkably, there are virtually no arguments against the existence of God, but different motivations, and I will dwell on them later on. And then a fourth or third piece of evidence is videos I've watched. So the Reasonable Faith videos by Craig and the Veritas Forum videos. And we will also see some of that video material. Just as, by way of example, here's one example. Here's Thomas Nagel, born 1937 and professor in the philosophy of law at New York University. Here's what he says. I want atheism to be true, and I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and actually hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope that there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. So here we have an atheist. He gives no argument. Something else is going on. This is just one example. I know I will get back to this later. But before that, I want to ask the question, why is it relevant to look at atheists? I mean, after all, in lots of countries, atheists are in the minority, maybe 5%, for instance, in the Netherlands. Why look at atheists? I've got a couple of reasons to do so, nonetheless, and let me mention three of them. First, lots of people are not explicit atheists, but they are implicit atheists. They don't really take the idea of there being a God seriously, and they live without God. So even if there are a few explicit ones, there are many who are implicit atheists. Second, at universities, the percentage is much higher. So in the Netherlands, it will be 5% among the general population, about 40% at the university. So for students and professors, The issue is much more important. There are many more atheists there. And the third reason to look at atheists is that we have something in common with them, something very important. Namely, lots of atheists and lots of Christians believe that the existence of God or the non-existence of God matters. It makes a difference. Whereas in Europe, lots of people just don't care. They don't care whether there is a God. And if there is a God, it doesn't make a difference to them. So I think that's also a reason why we should look at atheists. We share something with them. Okay. And let me mention one more reason why I think this whole discussion is important. There are lots of public debates these days, and also personal conversation with atheists. And my opinion is, I think I have noticed it a few times, that quite often the conversation is not taking place at the right level. So if it is true that an atheist is not primarily driven by arguments against the existence of God, but for different reasons, then you can argue for hours, for weeks, for centuries, but it's not going to make a difference to the atheist. Maybe to the audience, but not to the atheist. So we need to connect to the atheist at the right level. Finally, it's important because it seems that at least some atheists are sincerely seeking God. And there are a few passages in the Bible that say that those who will seek God will actually find him. So Luke 11 verse 9 is an example. There's one verse in Jeremiah as well. But at least some of them, it seems, sincerely attempt to find God but don't find him. How is this possible? Okay, that was the introduction. Here we go. The first one, I doubt whether I should call it a motivation, but it plays an important role. I call it misguided epistemological frameworks. The first one might be a bit controversial, but I think it's widely accepted among Christians these days, is that belief in God, this is what atheists, lots of atheists believe. Belief in God is rational only if there are good arguments for the existence of God. And I think Plantinga and Waldersdorf and others of Reformed epistemology have shown that that's not the case, as with many other things we believe. We don't need good arguments in order to rationally hold the belief in question. So what happens a lot is that they're looking for good arguments, searching those arguments. They don't find them, hence they don't believe in God. But maybe they don't need good arguments. A second important epistemological framework that is misguiding is the idea that we should avoid the Christian life in order to objectively assess the evidence. So here's a quote by Daniel Garber as an example. He's a philosophy professor at Princeton University. Here's what he says. I may know that if I subject myself to a certain regimen, for instance, engage in religious practices, then eventually I will attain a state in which I will believe in God, and I will believe that my belief is rational. But that isn't good enough. From a present point of view, it looks too much like intentional self-delusion. So the idea is, I shouldn't engage in Christian practices, because if I do, yes, surely then I will end up believing it. So in order to see whether the Christian belief is true, I should abstain from those practices. I should not engage in it. And I think that's a mistaken epistemological framework. Part of the Christian story is that by sin we have been alienated from God. And one of the core ideas of Christianity is that we should engage in those practices like prayer, scripture reading, kneeling before God, doing those things. And by going that way, we will run into the evidence for the existence of God. Maybe propositional evidence, maybe non-propositional evidence. So again, this is, I think, a mistaken epistemological framework. So what is needed here? Well, I think what is needed here is not primarily arguments for or against the existence of God, but a criticism of these two mistaken epistemological frameworks. Because as long as they have these frameworks, the arguments may not be successful for them. Okay, now we get more to the full-blown motivations. Here's one. The idea of being an independent thinker. I think it's quite often the case that the atheist doesn't want to be subjected to any external intellectual authority which tells him or her what he or she should do. And let's be honest, they find this an attraction. Maybe there's something attractive to it. Life looks like an adventure, an intellectual adventure. And the atheist is someone who likes that. That's something I say from my own experience. The idea is there's no pre-established meaning or purpose in life. We have to discover it ourselves. We have to create it ourselves. And that's the adventure of life. Look at this quote from Louisa Anthony. She's a professor at the University of Massachusetts. Here's what she says. We, atheists, have no sacred texts, no authorities with definitive answers to our questions about the nature of morality or the purpose of life, no list of commandments that cover every contingency and dilemma. We have no confidence, the evidence of history being as it is, that the truth will win out, or that goodness will triumph in the end. We have no fear of eternal punishment, but no hope either of eternal reward. We have only our ideals and our goals to motivate us, only our sympathy and our intelligence to make us good, and only our fellow human beings to help us in time of need. When we speak for ourselves. We cannot claim inspiration or sanction from the Creator and Lord of the universe. Here's someone who wants to think independently and thinks that thinking independently makes life an adventure. Here's another quote from Simon Layden, professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He writes, I think this is even more explicit, our existence is this one long walk on a tightrope over yawning abyss, and there is nothing to catch us should we fall into meaninglessness or isolation or even mere ordinariness. But that's exactly what I find so exhilarating about being an atheist. Life is up to us. There are no safety nets. It's a bracing thought, but it's also a reason to live. You see, this man is attracted. I mean, look at the imagery. This is no argument for the against the existence of God. He feels attracted to a particular way of life, being an independent thinker. No authority, no external authority like scripture or something. Well, how should we deal with this when we encounter this in public debates or in personal conversation? I'd like to make 5 suggestions. I think the first thing we should do is be humble and admit that the church has made mistakes about this in the past. There has been dogmatism, intellectual dependence, ferocious discussions on side issues that are not relevant to the core of the Christian faith. Luther talks about the freedom of being a Christian. I think that also encompasses intellectual freedom. But unfortunately, the church has made mistakes about this in the past, and I think we should freely admit that. Second, we should ask ourselves, again, this has to do with us, not with the atheist. We should ask ourselves, is it true that we have left the hard intellectual work to the atheists? How come that relatively few evangelicals are engaged in science in the United States? They're underrepresented compared to atheists, for instance. How come that happened? These are questions we should ask ourselves. But then I think there are also questions we should ask the atheist. I think we can explain to the atheist that being an independent thinker, or at least thinking open-mindedly, and being a Christian are perfectly compatible. All the major universities in the world were founded by Christians. Christians invented science, basically. I mean, there were attempts to do it in China and in the Middle East, and it worked for a while, but it was only in Europe, in Christian Europe, that it finally flourished. I think we could also mention well-known scientists and philosophers who are excellent thinkers and are Christians at the same time. People like C.S. Lewis, Francis Collins, Alvin Plantinga, Richard Swinburne, to give examples of the idea that being a good thinker and being a Christian are perfectly compatible. And finally, I think we should stress, especially as philosophers, we should stress that being a completely independent thinker is a myth. We cannot be completely independent thinkers. Even in science, for instance, we constantly rely on others. Who of us has checked the law of Boyle? Anyone? Still, we believe it. Who of us has been in Mongolia or to the moon? Nobody here. But we still believe that there is a moon out there, and we believe certain things about its surface. We believe that there is Mongolia and so forth. We rely on the testimony of other people all the time. So the idea of being a completely independent thinker is a complete myth. I move forward to another motivation. Following heroes or being a hero oneself. I think what happens quite a bit is that atheists read people like Bertrand Russell or Friedrich Nietzsche, and they admire them for their courage, their rhetoric, their intellectual power. But then, of course, their atheism is an inextricable part of their philosophy. Or what happens is they find out that reality is harsh, and they want to face it and be brave, so they want to be a hero themselves. In order to illustrate me this, let me give you an example. Let me show you a video in which Lewis Wolpert, well, he debates Wimbling Craig, but I'm just going to show you Lewis Wolpert. He's emeritus professor of biology at the University College of London. And I'm going to show you something he says in a debate. Now, superficially, it seems that he is giving arguments against the existence of God. So he says it makes you happy, it comes from tool-making, and so forth. But when you watch these fragments a couple of times, you will notice that he is using the following phrases. I am sorry to tell you. I regret to tell you. These are just a couple of fragments, but I think he does it 20 times in about half an hour. And that's what he does to the audience. I'm sorry to tell you. This is the truth. It's the sober truth. It's the harsh truth. But we have to accept it. What he is doing to the audience is that he's showing himself as a hero. He wants to face the harsh reality, and those in the audience who are Christians don't. This is not an argument against the existence of God. This is an irrational motivation. He wants to be a hero and face harsh reality by himself. And I think we should become sensitive to that, not just listen to the arguments, but listen to the rhetoric that is in a way behind the arguments, as this fragment shows. Well, how can we deal with this? Again, I don't think we need arguments for and against the existence of God here, although I do believe there are such good arguments. I've defended them myself at occasions. But I think what we should do is what you could call Christian hagiography. We should describe the lives of Christians that have been heroes in a way. People like Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the Second World War, an intellectual, a pastor, someone who defended the Jews and even planned an attack on Hitler and was murdered for it. Surely that is a hero. But most importantly, the person of Jesus Christ, not merely the gospel of his suffering, death and resurrection, but also his life. A completely mature human being who dared to face reality more than anyone else. That's what I think we should do when we encounter this. Or at least one of the things we can do. Okay, let's move on to another motivation. Disappointing and traumatic experiences. Well, of course, atheists, like everyone in this world, suffer at some times from traumatic and disappointing experiences. Religious education, for instance, can lead to continuous guilt. Here's how Stuart Shapiro from Ohio State University describes a particular experience he had. One day in February 1984, I was driving and listening to a radio news story about David Vetter, otherwise known as the Bubble Boy. The announcer said that he had been born 12 years before with a condition known as severe combined immune deficiency that robbed him of the usual defenses against infectious diseases. Since any infection would prove fatal, David lived in a sterile environment, a plastic bubble. He had no physical contact with any living organism. Eventually, the defense was breached and his doctors had to enter the bubble. David then hugged, so after 12 years, he hugged his mother for the first time and died a short time later, thus prompting the news story that day. And when you read on, when he describes this in the book, he says, when he heard that on the news radio, something snapped in him. Something snapped. Now, there is something irrational about this. People Adult human beings have known all along that these sorts of things happen, right? We've all heard about the Holocaust. Auschwitz is 70 kilometers away from here. We all know this. But then all of a sudden, one particular experience becomes more vivid than anything else, and people lose their faith in God. Although they knew this about the suffering for a long time. Okay, so here again we have a story of someone who clearly does not provide an argument against the existence of God. It's what we could call a traumatic experience, or a very disappointing experience at least. And I call it irrational because clearly an experience like that doesn't count against the existence of God. But clearly it has influenced his life. And it seems was one of the reasons why he became an atheist. Because if you're a Christian, then apparently you're not allowed to ask questions about, for instance, where does God come from? Now, how should we deal with this when we run into this? When we run into truly traumatic experiences, people who have suffered or have had a terrible youth because of the religious faith. I think we should deal with it in the same way as we deal with other traumas. Think of someone who has had an elevator accident. What should we do with someone who has had an elevator accident? I don't think we should come up with statistics and say, well, listen, this happens only one in a million times. So it's very unlikely that it happens again. Just go into that elevator. Look at the statistics. With traumatic experience, it doesn't work that way. What people need is good conversation and probably therapy, doing it step by step, maybe going into an elevator that doesn't move, then go into an elevator that goes up only one floor, and so forth. So step by step, they learn it by doing it. Same way here, if people have traumatic experiences, and maybe they come up with an argument, say the argument from suffering, we should take those arguments seriously, but we should pay attention to the underlying traumatic experiences and take them seriously. Here's another motivation for atheism: caricatures of belief in God. And let me be explicit that there can be different reasons for those caricatures. They can be willingly embraced, so people know better, but they present them nonetheless. They can be culpably ignorant. They could easily remove these caricatures, but they don't want to. Or they have these caricatures but are blameless for it. They just don't know any better, and they could not have known any better. Some examples, and again, this is based on the literature I read and the debates I've listened to. Here are some examples. Believers act morally because they want to be rewarded by God in heaven. I mean, this is clearly a character. When I bring my wife a bouquet of flowers, do I do so because I want to be rewarded by God in heaven? Come on, I do it because I love her. Here's another one. Believers think that they are the only ones who have something valuable to say on morality. Or here's another one. The entire Bible is meant literally and therefore conflicts with science. Or another one. Faith excludes rational thinking. These are caricatures. Just read a bit about the rich Christian intellectual history. Or read some commentaries on the Bible. Or even Daniel Dennett, a very good philosopher. Well, maybe he was a very good philosopher at certain points. He says, most religious believers refuse to critically reflect on their beliefs. I mean, how can he say such a thing? Look, I mean, he has thousands of Christian philosophical colleagues who do reflect critically on their beliefs. I think what we need to do here is not provide arguments against or for the existence of God, but provide knowledge, such as evidence, historical evidence, statistical evidence, and remove these caricatures and just correct them. Okay, another motivation. It's incredible how many motivations there are if you look at the literature and listen to people. Here's another one, moral repugnance. Well, what does this amount to? People find either God or the Christian faith morally repugnant. So here's Fernando Savater on the picture. He's professor of ethics. That's not a coincidence. Professor of ethics at the University of the Basque Country. He's written quite a few books on atheism, have been translated into many languages. And he calls God a supernatural tyrant. whose goodness is not allowed to be the object of discussion. There's a lot about God that atheists find morally repugnant. Here are a few things. God chooses a specific people, Israel. God allows people to suffer in order to test them. God commands atrocities. Think of Deuteronomy 7. Innocent children are drowned during the flood. Religious convictions lead to conflict. And maybe most importantly, God created or allowed hell to exist. But there's also a lot atheists find morally repugnant about believers or believing in God. And when you talk to them, time and again, they come up with things like the Crusades. Maybe you've had this experience. The Crusades. Dogmatism and judging others. The sexual policy of the Roman Catholic Church in South Africa. The lack of freedom in expressing one's opinion. And so forth. Now, there's something strange about this motive. It's irrational in the sense that if believing in God is immoral, it doesn't follow that there is no God, right? It's not an argument against the existence of God. And even if God is morally repugnant, it doesn't follow that there is no God, unless you adhere to some classical Anselmian conception of God on which he is omnibenevolent. So it would be a lesser than perfect being, but still something or someone very much like God. And let me show you a video fragment with Richard Dawkins, which I think illustrates this nicely. So he's having a debate with Howard Condor, who is the founder of the UK Christian television program Revelation TV. And here's what he said. A life for a life, what kind of a morality is that? Clearly, Richard Dawkins doesn't give an argument against the existence of God here. He's morally repelled by the Christian faith and by the kind of God that is portrayed in the Christian faith. How should Christians deal with this when they encounter it in public debates or personal conversations? May I make three suggestions? First, I think we should do careful biblical exegesis. So, for instance, they often appeal to the story of Abraham sacrificing his son. I think this is Genesis 22, okay, good. They often refer to this, and they think it shows that God is immoral because he demands a human sacrifice. Now, I think we should look carefully at this passage. And I think given God's commandments in the Old Testament, it's very, very unlikely that God would ever have allowed Abraham to sacrifice his own son there. And there's much more going on in the passage. So the first thing is to look carefully at the relevant passages. Second, I think the Christian should stress that we cannot always rely on moral intuitions. One of the basic tenets of the Christian faith is that sin pervades our entire life. And that means not just our emotions and our actions, but also our beliefs and intuitions. And I've written a bit about this myself, about what I call the cognitive consequences of sin. And I think sin is also affected, directly or indirectly, our moral intuitions. They're not always reliable. So maybe we do find things morally repugnant, but we also have reasons to distrust that particular intuition. Finally, I think the Christian should point out that the discussion about God's presumably immoral character or immoral deeds is part and parcel of the Christian faith itself. There's the book of Job in the Bible, there's Lamentations, and there are other stories in which believers ask God or cry to God because they don't understand God and don't understand his actions and find it immoral what he does. Right? So it's not forbidden to have moral problems with God or with God's action. This is part of the Christian faith. It's part of our relationship with God, and this is allowed. It's not forbidden. Okay, I think we're almost through the motivations, but maybe two more. Unwillingness to surrender one's status or possessions. Now, everyone who knows the Christian faith will realize that You can become a Christian only if you are willing to give up certain things and follow Christ. And this is a road that often goes downwards. As Henry Nouwen, who's on the sheet here, has argued in a well-known booklet. And I think it's not unlikely that some people are atheists simply because they're unwilling to do so. And let's be honest, even as a Christian, it's often terribly hard. I find myself often unwilling to take this road downwards. And the moment I refuse to go this road downwards, I quickly alienate from God. I become estranged from God. And if this is true for us, then maybe it's true for the atheist as well. Christ says in Luke 9, "If anyone to become my followers, then let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it." Now, it's not easy how we should deal with this when we encounter this in personal conversation or in apologetics. And I think this is not easy because what the atheist needs on the most fundamental level here is conversion. And by conversion, I mean turning around towards God and confessing that we're limited, sinful human beings, and that we need to learn to follow Christ because we can't do it ourselves. We can't save ourselves. And if this is what motivates the atheist, then I think what the Christian should do is confront him with this in an atmosphere of honesty and love and pray for that person. Here's one that I wanted to mention because I'm not sure about it. And I would like to hear your opinions about it. It's an idea, a suggestion, a speculation. I think it's possible that there are relational obstacles between God and man that make it impossible for the atheist to find God, even though certainly not impossible for God to find the atheist. There's a well-known passage in the Bible, Matthew 5, where Jesus says, "So when you're offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother and sister, and then come and offer your gift." So apparently, it's hard, if not impossible, to make contact, vertical contact with God, when we're not living in peace on a horizontal level with our neighbors and our friends. I think God can breach through this, just to be clear. And also this passage is about believers. It's something Jesus says to believers. But nonetheless, I think it is possible, but this is a speculation, that atheists find God, but don't live in peace with their family or friends. And therefore, there is an obstacle for them to find God. Again, I'm not sure about this, but maybe it's possible. If this is the case, then I think what we should do is encourage them to both sincerely seek God, but also be reconciled with their friend, with their brother, with their sister. Okay, these are the motivations I wanted to mention today. Are these all the motivations there are? No, I think there are more. But I'm not going to deal with them in detail, but I'm just going to list them. Some people have the feeling that religion is losing terrain to science. Religion can explain less and less, science can explain more and more. Does it follow that there is no God? Of course it doesn't follow. It's not a good argument. But it might motivate one. It has a certain appeal. Peer pressure. Working at a university where everyone is an atheist, or living in Amsterdam where less than 3% of the people go to church on Sunday. That has affected me. I've struggled with it. And it's purely irrational. It's not an argument against the existence of God. Peer pressure. Aesthetic repugnance. Let's be honest. Quite a few church gatherings are messy, noisy, folksy, and atheists, especially those who are well educated, may be repelled by it. They might just dislike it for aesthetic reasons. Another one is character traits. This is a recent development. There has been research psychological research on autism and atheism. And I can give you the references later. But it turns out that a comparably high percentage of atheists has autism. Now, if you have autism, then you have trouble recognizing the intentions of others, right? And if this is true, it may very well be that this influences one's belief about there being another person with intentions towards this world, namely God. And then finally, Paul Witz, there he is, has argued in a famous book, The Faith of the Fatherless, I think it was 1990, that lots of atheists have distorted relationships with their father, particularly their father, and that has distorted their image of God. And that might be a motivation for atheism. So this is just a list, and probably there are even more, but I'm not going to deal with them in detail. What I would like to do, in closing this talk, is ask the question to you and to myself, what does all this mean for the rationality or irrationality of atheism and theism? And this is maybe the more philosophical, I think there has been some philosophy in there so far, but this is slightly more philosophical than what I've said so far. Okay, the first thing I think we should notice is that according to Reformed epistemology, and Calvin argues the same, Thomas Aquinas argues, well, or at least claims the same, belief in God can be rational even if the Christian has no arguments for the existence of God, or even if there are no arguments for the existence of God. Why is that? Well, because if God exists, then it's likely that he has implanted some kind of mechanism in us that produces belief in God, sensus divinitatis. So that in certain circumstances, like reading the Bible or watching the beautiful landscape here outside, you experience something of God and come to believe in God or maintain belief in God. And that can make it rational in the same way as experiences of chairs and light can make my beliefs about chairs and light rational. Okay, so I think theism can be rational without any arguments. Now, can atheism be rational without any arguments? In other words, can any of the motivations I mentioned or other possible motivations that are not arguments, can they make atheism rational? Well, one first option one could defend is say, well, atheism can be a properly basic intuition in the same way as belief in God can be a properly basic belief. I think this idea would be problematic. If there is a God, then God can cause in us certain beliefs via some kind of mechanism, right? If there is no God, then our beliefs came about by some kind of evolutionary processes, right? By those processes themselves or as a byproduct. But clearly it has no evolutionary advantage or disadvantage to believe in God for survival. Well, it can be good on a group level or some such thing, but one can perfectly well survive believing in God, and one can perfectly well survive not believing in God. So it's hard to see how atheism could ever be properly basic. Then one might think, well, maybe there are atheistic experiences, like there are experiences of God. One can have a mystic experience of God and experience God directly. Maybe there are atheistic experiences. Again, I don't find this convincing. One can have something like a desert experience, right? The world seems empty and desolate and cruel. Maybe that's the case. Still, it differs from an experience of God. If one experiences God, God is out there and we experience him. When we experience the desertness, or the desert of life, so to say, we don't experience the non-existence of God. We experience a desert or suffering or something else. And then we need something of a further step to conclude that there is no God. That is, we need some kind of argument. Something like, if there were a God, then I wouldn't have this experience. Or these experiences would not exist. So then again, we need some kind of argument. Finally, can't we have properly basic beliefs about something's absence? I mean, I look at this chair, And I immediately see, without any kind of argument, that there is no one sitting on this chair. There is no one here. I don't need an argument for that. I just see it directly. There's no one here. Everyone is absent from this chair. Isn't it possible, in the same way that we experience or intuitively feel the absence of God from the universe? And here again, I think the answer has to be no, that's not possible. I can see that there is no one in this chair because I can see the entire chair, and I'm sure that there's no one in there. Not so with God. It's very well possible that the atheist has not experienced God or has not seen God. But even on atheism, that could be the case because God has not revealed himself yet. He hasn't shown himself yet. So this doesn't apply because we can't overview the entirety of reality in the same way as we can see maybe the entire reality of this chair. Right, so it may very well be that God exists, but that he hasn't shown or revealed himself to the atheist yet. Hence, I think it follows that there is a crucial epistemological asymmetry between theism on the one hand, especially Christian belief, and atheism on the other hand. You can be a Christian or a theist without any good arguments for the existence of God, but if you are to be an atheist, a rational atheist, you do need arguments for the existence of God. So all the motivations I've mentioned in this lecture, we need to take them seriously, but they don't count in favor of atheism, none of them. Finally, what does this mean for sincerely seeking God? I think it follows that we can acknowledge that at least some atheists are sincerely seeking God, but not finding him. Why is that? Well, because of maybe relational obstacles, maybe a caricature, or maybe some of the other motivations. So I think we can acknowledge their sincere quest for God, and at the same time say God will reveal himself to those who seek him, and we can help them to overcome these irrational motivations for atheism and thereby to find God. This is what I wanted to say to you. And these are a few questions that I would like to ask you. And I think we have about half an hour left. Oh, a bit less, 20 minutes maybe. 20 minutes for discussion. Please share any ideas or thoughts. And these are some questions that we don't need to answer them. But these are questions in case there are no questions. So I think, what do they teach us about life, about ourselves, and about God, these motivations for atheism? Which ones have you encountered in personal conversations, or maybe in a public discussion? How did you deal with them? How would you deal with them now? And finally, do you find my argument at the end convincing that atheism can be rational only if there are good arguments for it?